Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I'm your host, Ted Flanagan. Happy to be here. Happy to have Andrew McAllister on the show today. Commissioner Andrew McAllister, third term Commissioner Andrew McAllister of the California Energy Commission. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you.
Well, great to see you, Ted. Long time and looking forward to catching up.
Yeah, how have you been?
Doing well. As you know, there's a lot going on in the energy space and the clean energy transition, and lots of very smart people focused on forging solutions and getting California kind of to help chart that path. You know, I think we're in a leadership position, and as it should be, and we're doing a lot of innovative things, and they're going to be relevant, not just across the nation, but across the globe. So.
Now, you look like you're sitting in your office. I see some framed photos or plaques, it looks like, in the background. Is that right?
That is right. I've got them fuzzed out, but those are, I'm actually in a dentist's office. No, I'm kidding. A lot of degrees back there, a lot of plaques, whatever, but yeah.
You're in Sacramento as we speak.
No, I'm actually in my home office. I'm in my home office. You know, as most of us working from home quite often, we're now doing our business meetings mostly in the office once a month.
Yeah,
but I'm at home, and maybe it's a point of interest. A few years ago, I did actually build an all electric passive house, and have been living in it for a few years, and it's fantastic. It's just a better product.
Yeah, I was gonna get to that, because I remember when you were when you were building it. But before we back up and get into your youth and kind of where you grew up and all that, what are you working on? What's hot right now? What's on the docket? I guess that's a loaded word in your world.
Several different things. I'm excited about a few different things. You know, I'm the lead commissioner on energy efficiency buildings. I've been doing a lot on data and utilizing kind of big data for good in the policy realm, which I think is unique for a state energy office, really, or any regulator for that matter. And also load flexibility is something we're working on a number of fronts to kind of harness as a resource to do that tripartite of things, right? To underpin reliability, to decarbonize, and to contain costs as we invest in this transition in the electric system. And so those are all kind of different activities to put together, you know, to help our clean energy transition happen efficiently and well and quickly. The other thing, which is quite different, is, you know, and for the rest of this week, actually, there's an increasing discussion across the Western states about regional integration of the electric grid potentially. So, you know, certainly not a done deal, but there's a lot of different opinions about what that could look like. Certainly a fair amount of political content too, but it's interesting, and it's good to be engaged with the states to talk about those issues.
You seem like you're really thriving in the position. You're in your third term now.
It's true. I certainly would not have anticipated doing this for three terms. You know, it's a good gig. You know, I've been doing energy my whole career, since college, you know, since graduation in the late 80s. We're able to make how many, you know, roles can you have that provide some levers to actually make a difference in people's lives and really create a better world for your kids and grandkids. I mean, it's very fulfilling in that way.
It's got to be. Well, thank you for what you're doing. Let's back all the way up. As a kid, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, which has been in the news lately for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Nashville way. As a kid, what were you thinking about? Were you like me playing sports and knocking around in the woods or what?
Pretty much, yeah. Lots of nature, you know. I'm a proud Californian now, just to be clear. I've been living here for more than half my life. Just nature, water, humidity, green, you know, summer, salamanders, you know, snakes and scorpions, you know, in the mountains. Kind of childhood.
And then up to Dartmouth, where I had lots of friends that went to Dartmouth up in, where's it, Hanover?
Yeah, up in Hanover, yeah.
New Hampshire.
Yeah, and that's where I really started kind of understanding how important energy was when I was studying engineering there. I actually did a double major with art history as my first major and engineering as my second major. But
that's got to be an unusual combination.
Well, it actually serves me well. It's, you know, the left brain, right brain, you need both, you know, and learning how to write, that was pretty key, certainly to what I'm doing now. But, and, you know, take thermodynamics and your head, your mind gets kind of blown about, you know, there's really no free lunch energetically. And so we just have to be very responsible with our energy planning.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, I did spend, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, but I did work internationally in developing countries for more than a decade. And, you know, there, especially in places where the grid is not going to get, but really everywhere, you're not counting kilowatt hours, you're counting watt hours. You know, you really have to be parsimonious with your energy consumption, especially if you're, you know, your only energy source is a, your only, you know, clean energy source is a small rooftop solar system. You got to be very careful with how much energy you use. So most people across the globe are much more conscious of that than we are here.
Yeah. Was Dana Meadows at Dartmouth when you were there?
She was, yeah. I had a class with her. And she was just, I think, just a vision, just a leading light of sustainability and equity and justice.
Yeah.
Really amazing, inspiring leader.
Yeah. Yeah. And then
and her husband, you know, her then partner, Dennis Meadows, actually also, they were key in the Club of Rome and writing, you know, really just thinking about sustainability and the limits to growth, right, is the big book that they all wrote together.
Yeah. I just had Hunter Lovins on the podcast.
And oh, great.
Dana Meadows. And when I was at Rocky Mountain Institute, I went back and spoke at Dana Meadows' classes each year at Dartmouth.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, she left us way, way too soon. You know, real tragedy.
Now, was the Peace Corps next or did you go to graduate school next?
So I worked for one field season up in the White Mountains taking meteorological data when traipsing around the White Mountains and then went to the Peace Corps down in Costa Rica. And, you know, that was a very formative experience for me. Just first long term. Well, I guess I had been in Kenya for 6 months during college. I took a term off and did an off-campus program in Kenya. So I had kind of some international kind of exposure, developing country, but really, you know, being tasked with going and making a positive difference in a place that you had to really learn about from scratch, I think was empowering, but it was also very humbling. And it was, you know, Peace Corps is a great program. I think certainly Peace Corps volunteers get a lot more out of it than the communities as a rule, but I think it does build you know, friendship and solidarity as well.
Well, is that what sparked this interest? You went to work for NRECA, the National Rural Electric Cooperatives Association International, I guess, international division. Is that right? What sparked your interest in working internationally or?
So I knew I wanted to work internationally. I mean, certainly the Peace Corps, you know, sort of opened my eyes to Latin America. And to this day, I have a love for Latin America that's super deep in my heart. And in fact, my daughter's spring break was last week and we spent the week in Medellin, Colombia, just to go check it out. And so I came back from the Peace Corps to go to grad school for the first time at UC Berkeley at the Energy and Resources Group. And that was my indoctrination into, or just my exposure to energy efficiency and, you know, just being in the same room with Art Rosenfeld and, you know, Ed Vine, Marianne Piette, you know, just lots of Mark Levine, just really smart, Chuck Goldman, just being, you know, on the same floor with all of these icons of just good energy management and just solid research and understanding and innovation in the energy space. And so, you know, LBNL is just one of the global nodes for efficiency work and research policy, amazing resource that we have here in the state. So I was there for 2 years. And then actually to write my master's project, I cut a deal with NRACA, my then manager there. They had a short-term consulting gig actually that I took, and I went down to Bolivia for, you know, 6 weeks and then 2 months and then 6 months. And then they just hired me. So I ended up staying in Bolivia for 7 years and wrote my master's thesis from Hotel Copacabana in La Paz, Bolivia, which was the same place that Che Guevara stayed when he was through La Paz. Little tidbit. But so, yeah, that was a beautiful experience, just doing rural electrification and actually industrial load management, working on both the efficiency side and the renewable side, in a sometimes a challenging environment, but also one that was really open for interesting things and projects and new technologies, which solar then was, right, in the early 90s.
How close did you get to actual installs? Were you ever?
Oh, I've done it, the hundreds of installs with these hands. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was an engineering job more than really anything else. Specking and importing equipment, and you know, there were simple systems, but back then, you know, we didn't have the power electronics that we have now. So we had square wave inverters and you know, flooded lead acid batteries, and you know, that was what there was. And
what got you back to the States then? It sounds like you were leading a life of meaning and adventure in Bolivia.
It was, well, in the 90s was really an era of innovation in solar. There really wasn't grid connected solar. Pretty much it was off grid. It was still expensive. And you know, nobody was really thinking about at that time or could really make it pencil to connect solar to the grid. So it was very exciting and really fulfilling because it was, you know, going to communities that really needed basic energy services and helping them figure out how they could get that. But at the end of the 90s, late 90s, the former dictator of Bolivia was elected as the president. And it sort of changed the tenor of the engagement there. And I think, you know, closed off some doors of collaboration for me. And my learning curve was kind of leveling off anyway. So I decided to come back and go back to grad school at the same program and try to get a PhD.
Which you did.
Which I did. I eventually did. It took me a while, but I had a lot of starts and stops. So yeah, in a proud Berkeley tradition.
Well, then I think when I first met you, you were working at the Center for Sustainable Energy down in San Diego.
I think that's right. Yeah. And that was one of the distractions actually, before, you know, finally buckling down and finishing my dissertation. But that's a leading, you know, nonprofit based in San Diego that we were administering the California Solar Initiative in SDG&E service territory. We were doing a lot of energy efficiency, the self-generation incentive program. We were just really the only non-utility that was administering these programs. And I think that was a very kind of, in a way, powerful place to be because, you know, I think the Public Utilities Commission looked to us to sort of speak the truth and not be wrapped up in that whole, you know, the regulated environment that the utilities were. And, you know, they're all good people. I'm not knocking anybody, but I think we really had a sort of a solutions-based approach to those programs and really zero conflicts in terms of wanting to just do the right thing and get solar out there and get these new technologies out there to take advantage of these programs.
Is it still going strong?
The Center for Sustainable Energy?
Yeah.
They dropped the California, it's CSE and not CCSE now. And they've opened offices in other parts of the country. And, you know, I think they're doing quite well.
So tell me, how did it come about for you to become a commissioner of the California Energy Commission, which is just a huge, hugely wonderful step?
I probably don't even know the whole story, right? I think, at that time, you know, Jerry Brown had just become governor for the second time. So he was in his third of four terms overall. Right.
Yeah.
And I kind of got recruited by some locals in San Diego with the idea that, you know, the tail end of the state is just not represented on the major commissions. And Southern California in general just, you know, wasn't maybe heard in Sacramento as much as some folks some folks thought it should be. And certainly San Diego, you know, being on the other side of LA, you know, it's kind of not a policy, you know, mecca. And I think kind of felt taken for granted. And so I sort of reluctantly said, okay, well, I'll apply. But, you know, I really enjoyed what I was doing at the center. And so I applied and kind of just, that was that for a little while. But I did get a call from the governor's office, and I knew some folks there, you know, Cliff Rechtschaffen, who was with Jerry Brown during some really formative years of the energy policy development in the state, Ken Alex, as well. And, you know, Cliff gave me a call and said, oh, you know, you're on the short list, but we're not going to go for you, you know, this time. And that was Carla Peterman who got that appointment, that first appointment in year one of Jerry Brown. Of Brown too. And then, so I was kind of relieved actually, and sort of, okay, went back to what I was doing. Then a year went by, there was another spot in the commission that opened up. And that's when they said, okay, are you still interested? Cause you know, we think you could do some good up here. And I took the plunge, you know, my wife Leslie was, you know, she had just gotten tenure at USD law school but you know, we were all game. So we took the plunge.
God, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. And then what has been the best thing about it? I think you alluded to this prior or a little earlier, just the sense of fulfillment, being able to do something on scale. But how would you articulate that? What's been the best thing at the commission for you?
That's a great question. You know, the Energy Commission is known across the world for kind of starting building energy efficiency standards, appliance efficiency standards, you know, back in the 70s, back in the Art Rosenfeld days, when it was kind of a small heady group that was inventing this thing called energy efficiency. And I think it's matured over the decades since, and we really have a process that's well-defined and it produces results. And so I feel like this is my first time in state service, certainly. The only other time in government service was in the Peace Corps. And so, you know, I think folks like to diss government, you know, as being bureaucratic and slow and all that. But I think actually in California, I have taken heart actually from being in this position, because I see the process. I see the dedicated people who are behind the process. And I've seen time after time that the process of developing, you know, even from before the statute exists through the statute and then into the regulatory process, there's a lot of embedded wisdom in that process, and it works. You know, it's basically a manifestation of California's robust democracy, which, you know, it's easy for people who aren't in California to take pot shots at us. Oh, we're crazy Californians, so much regulation, yada, yada. But it is actually regulation that works and that our populace supports. And if it's done right, it has a huge positive impact. And so the process ensures that it's done right. And so I really lean on the process. So to answer your question, I think just having some known, very effective levers to do good in a way that only the state can is it's a blessing. It really is to be able to, you know, be fair and inclusive and have a rigorous process that gets everybody to the table to figure stuff out. That's just, there's a lot of power in that. And I just really have felt a lot of gratitude, feel a lot of gratitude for being able to be in the position to help usher that process forward.
And you mentioned Art Rosenfeld, I think already, who was at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, of course, for years, and he became a commissioner at the DC. And I think
he always said it was the best job he ever had.
And in his honor, we now have a unit of energy, right? Or a unit of power. Isn't the 500 megawatt coal plant considered, or 500 megawatts of capacity is one Rosenfeld? Or
yeah, I think it's an energy metric. So it's the energy that 500 megawatts of coal produces over the course of a year, I think.
It's in the gigawatt hours or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's a heady group of you know, original thinkers that sort of came up together with Art, with, you know, what we now refer to as the energy efficiency industry. And Chris Caldwell, you know, and John Coomey and a few others came up with that metric for Art.
Yeah, it's really touching. It's great. Now, am I right that in January of this year, the standard or the Title 24 requirement for solar and new commercial construction took place?
Yeah, so some selected non-residential buildings and multifamily. It had been, as of 2020, there had been a solar requirement for single-family residential, and we expanded that somewhat into some non-residential. And we're talking, I won't be able to just, you know, rattle off the whole list, but it's
Oh, there was grocery stores and hospitals and hotels and office
exactly.
buildings. But
Exactly. Places where it makes sense.
one of the big and bold steps was to require solar on all new residential construction. And that started in 2020. I thought all commercial was not going to start until 2030. But
well, so Diane Gruenick, back in her days at the CPUC, did that big bold strategies, which is what you're referring to. And required solar came out of that as one of, I think, four big bold strategies for the long term. It might even have been net zero energy buildings. But I think that's the way it was articulated then. You know, since then, a lot of water under the bridge. I mean, you know, you don't, since then, we have actually adopted, you know, goals SB 32 and SB 100. And, you know, we actually are under a statutory requirement that we clean up our grid, our electric grid, to be 100% carbon free by 2045. And we're well on the way to doing that. And so with that context, you know, it doesn't make that a fundamental difference as to whether those electrons come from one side of the meter or the other side of the meter. So, you know, there are a lot of ways to get to a clean energy grid. I would argue that having heavy energy efficiency and reducing the overall consumption, and then having a lot of load flexibility that enables you to level your load shape out so that you have a better, you know, capacity factor overall for the system. Those are the two most important things you can do to manage it cost effectively. And then, you know, behind the meter solar, rooftop solar is absolutely a very important part of the supply of those clean electrons, but also our large solar, you know, on the transmission grid. I think there's no if or, there's really a, you know, a
you know,
and. We need it all.
Need it all. Well, would you say that, I mean, it must have been a significant challenge, or it must have been a battle to get that approved, or to get that Title 24 building standard put into place, right? I mean,
I've referred to the process before. It definitely was. I mean, you know, like part of my role is to take arrows, you know, when people are unhappy. And so, you know, I did some of that. But every 3 years, you know, we adopt an updated building code. And so that was a particularly notable one. The solar was not the only thing that was in that building code update. We did a lot of efficiency. We did, we did some joint appendices in the back of it to, you know, promote batteries and you know, flexible demand heat pump water heaters and stuff. I mean, so it had a lot of innovation in it. That's what kind of captured the headlines for sure, the solar requirement. But I think every 3 years we have, you know, a suite of innovations that come to the building code, and they all have to be shown. We have to show that they are cost effective and feasible. And so we did that with solar. And I think we did it in such a rigorous and robust way that stakeholders saw, yeah, you know, it's going to happen because it's cost effective and feasible. And that was actually the manifestation of 20 years of policy and support and development of the solar industry that enabled us to be in that position.
Are we close to that position now for batteries also?
You know, we're doing the numbers now, and, you know, the supply chain for batteries just is kind of, it's a little problematic in terms of how we're going to get costs down. So we're hard pressed to sort of project costs for batteries going down enough to make a requirement for batteries cost effective. We got sharp pencils and we're looking at it each 3 year cycle. But I think the other issue there is that load flexibility has to be valued. And so in order to produce, you know, a cost-effective outcome, you got to actually be able to plausibly argue that when you provide that flexibility and it's used to help the grid function, say on a peak summer day or every day, you know, with a time of use rate or something, that it actually does produce the cash flow that makes it cost-effective and feasible. And so the rate environment, you know, at the Public Utilities Commission and the POU, you know, boards needs to evolve to sort of unlock that cost effectiveness for those kinds of end uses.
Right. Very interesting. Let's talk decarbonization for a minute. I wanted to ask you, you know, it just seems to me that our challenge, you mentioned the utilities have to be 100% green by 2045, I guess it is in California. And then we've got this big challenge of decarbonizing. We want to get rid of all the natural gas use in buildings, and back east, of course, it's other fossil fuels. And then at the same time, we want to take all the cars, get rid of the internal combustion engines, and throw that onto the grid. We're doing pretty well, but can we handle these big additions to our power grid while still attaining our greening goals for the grid?
So you're asking a common question, can we handle all this new load from transportation and buildings and industry, actually, as we electrify some of the thermal processes in industry across the state? And I rely on kind of structural thinking about how investments are actually made in the grid and how rates ensure and rate making ensures that cost recovery takes place and that those capital investments are actually paid for. And so it's just starting to appear. We're seeing this growth in electricity consumption, largely due to transportation electrification, and it'll get to buildings. Buildings will be another wedge that grows, and some of the industrial stuff. Industrial process shifts will also create some upward pressure or upward consumption. So as that takes place, and as we capture that in the forecast, so the Energy Commission does the forecast every 2 years, a full forecast of energy demand in the state across electricity, gas, liquid fuels. We're now doing, incorporating a rooftop solar forecast and a fuel switching forecast and a transportation electrification forecast, and all of that rolls up into the state's energy demand forecast. That forecast will capture these trends. We're really doing a lot of scenario analysis to make sure that the realm of possibility is kind of captured in the various scenarios. And then we kind of come down, we think this is the most reasonable one. Well, there's an executive order that, all light duty passenger vehicles are going to be electric by 2035. And so that's a policy scenario that's going to capture that consumption. And so knowing that forecast, then every 2 years it goes over to an update every other year, right? Goes to the PUC so that they can order the utilities to do the proper amount of procurement. That also works its way into the distribution system investment plans that the utilities put together. Okay, we're going to need all this, reconductoring or, new transformers, whatever. And then that goes into the rate base. And so that process really can't capture these forward costs, in my view. And I think, it's out of phase maybe a couple few years, but I think we have the apparatus to kind of get ahead of that. And then it also goes over the forecast to CAISO so they can do transmission planning. And so our forecast is incorporated into their transmission plan that they do periodically as well. So, I think our planning, our structure for planning investment across the electric grid can capture the load growth, but it is a new paradigm. We're also going to be bringing a lot of renewables onto the grid every year, year after year, and a lot of batteries. And so, those transmission investments and distribution plans, investment plans really take on kind of new urgency to get it right every time they're updated.
So the common question has an answer that I think you're pretty optimistic, Andrew, that if you get your market signals right, you do your proper planning, you get the pricing correct out there into the market, that the resources will follow.
I think that's right. I mean, I think some of the challenges, I mean, I am optimistic because I know how many, smart, dedicated people are working on this alignment from across all the agencies, the governor's office, key people in the legislature. I just think that the policy apparatus has embraced the clean energy transformation. That doesn't mean it's going to be straightforward in all cases. I mean, we still have siting for power, the various kinds of generation facilities, for transmission. Those projects take a lot of effort and a lot of planning, and we do have to get better at speeding that process up, because we don't have 10 years to build these facilities or transmission lines, so we have to make sure that we're able to site and build. So that's a big project in the state. A lot of jobs, a lot of upside for our economy, and so I think there's, you know, the winds are blowing in the right direction, but we gotta get it done.
Yeah, good stuff. Last couple of questions. You mentioned your house earlier in the podcast, and I think you said it's comfortable and it's serving you well. Talk about it. I mean, you're going from this great statewide policy level. I know you've been working nationally and internationally, but then here you are in this home. What's great about it?
Well, I appreciate the question. I mean, I wanted to put myself through the California Building Code, right? I mean, you know, I make everybody else do it. I got to walk the walk here. And I did have the opportunity to kind of score sort of the worst house on a really nice block in Davis, where we live. And initially was going to update the house and sort of figure out how we could retrofit it, but pretty quickly realized that, you know, it was an old cinder block house from the early 50s. And it just, you know, was going to be very difficult and challenging to upgrade it. So we used the slab, but we raised the house and built new. And so it's got, you know, thick walls and triple pane windows and you know, no thermal breaks, across the, or no thermal connectivity, you know, across the walls. It's got thermal breaks between the indoor and, you know, inside and outside. And that's the essence of a supervision house, is the envelope, the building shell. And then just all heat pumps all around. It's not rocket science. I mean, these technologies are off the shelf technologies, but how you integrate them, how you build them together, that attention to detail really matters. So it's so close to downtown Davis. It's in central Davis. My next door neighbor is actually a fraternity. Okay, so it's right across the street from UC Davis, right? So the Pike House is my backdoor neighbor. And they, every now and then, you know, have big parties, springtime, after midterms, after finals, they'll tear it out, you know, and I can't hear almost anything in the house. And that has turned out to be a very, positive outcome or benefit of passive house. It's super quiet. The indoor air quality is great. It's just a better product all around. Not that the fraternity neighbors are bad neighbors. They're actually pretty good neighbors, but, just my neighbors complain about like, oh, the noise, and I can't hear a thing. So
I'm sure if you ever need a beer, Andrew, you can just sort of
invite everybody over, but, a lot of connection to nature and good land, you know, sort of green out the doors and windows. I mean, it's all part of a package, you know, it's just kind of quality of life. So, you know, I'm lucky to be able to live in a walkable neighborhood. And the house just sort of really supports the kind of responsible life and sort of trying to be low impact in our day-to-day lives. It's one thing it showed me is that it is actually doable. And, you know, if we, as we incorporate many of these innovations into the building code and we try to get to a dual heat pump baseline for the building code and really go. I mean, we're really going all in on electric for the building code, that these technologies are available, they're doable, that the marketplace can install them well, and the outcomes will be good for people. You know, induction cooktops rock. They just are awesome. And so, and heat pumps do great work and they're super quiet and they're just, so it's a little adjustment, but it's sort of like that iPhone, you know, you didn't know you needed it until you had it and then it was awesome and you couldn't be without it. That's the way I kind of think about the house. And so it was a very gratifying project and just actually, you know, we made a video about the project. If you wanted to, you know, post that into the posting for this, put the link in the posting for this podcast. I can provide it to you, but whenever you have, anybody has 12 minutes to invest in watching a video about the commissioner's home build project.
That'd be great. Well, listen, thanks so much for being the commissioner, having the vision, walking the talk. It's been great catching up with you.
Well, thank you, Ted, just for all the stuff you do. I mean, you are a lion in this field, and I just really was excited to talk to you today and just really want to congratulate you on EcoMotion and all the amazing impact you've had over the years, because it's a big, big deal. We can't do what we do, you know, in the formal government environment without stakeholders who push us to innovate and who figure out the directions that the state can go to get to our long-term goals. And so really, you're a really important part of that ecosystem. So thank you.
Oh, All right. Thanks so much. Have a great afternoon.
You got to take care, Ted.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.